Good morning. Jackson 5 is because, have you heard Jackson 5? They're awesome. And so there's no profound meaning behind it. It's not like last week to where Keith Green was on because he is recognized widely as a prophetic voice in the 80s. This is because little Mike, love him. And if you can hear ABC 1, 2, 3 five times in a day, it's a good day. Like, you've never had a bad day that began and ended in Jackson 5. So that is my spiritual, profound reason why that was supposed to be our break time. So, again, welcome to Coast Hills. We are a Jesus-centered community creating gracious space through acts of generous love, which means if you are new here, welcome to our dysfunctional family. If you're not new here, you already know that's true. And it's a good thing. We're unique, we're special. That's enough said. But we do things with heart, we do things with passion, because what we see is more beautiful than self. Our hope in stepping into the What's Stirring series is that we'll get in touch with the idea of the we. That our dream, our moving forward, the extension of us, is the only hope we have that the kingdom we envision, that the world we want to see, will come into being, because God works incarnationally. Throughout Scripture, God worked through humanity. Even in the most redemptive act of Jesus, God became flesh and said, moved into the neighborhood. And that's what we're celebrating with APES. So what's stirring? We're going to move from prophet to teacher. And I'd like to open today with a prayer from Walter Brueggemann, just because I thought it was apt. So pray with me. Holy God, in this precious hour we pause and gather to hear your word. To do so, we break from our work responsibilities, from our play fantasies. We move from our fears that overwhelm, from our ambitions that are too strong. Free us in these moments from every distraction, that we may focus to listen, that we may hear, and that we may change. Amen. So stepping into this, last week we talked about the prophet and the prophetic voice. This week we're going to be talking about the teacher. The way today will go is we're going to go through the ancient concept of what a teacher was that permeates the biblical narrative and that surrounds the book of Ephesians, which is our base text. Then we'll move into what I would call the immature and mature aspect of the teacher, or as some would say, the shadow self or the strength, if you're reading Church's Movement, which has been one of our sources for the series. So we can struggle to see our own character's strength. It's like often when you ask, what's your qualities, we have a hard time. But when you say, where have you put your foot in it, what have you messed up, like we can recognize ourselves there. So today will be a little autobiographical, and I'll use my own story of maturing as a teacher, hopefully highlighting some areas of growth along the way, so that if you cringe at any of the stories, it might be because we share some of the same traits for the fivefold ministry of teacher. So I'd like to start with a story. The audacity of youth, Galatians, Pastor Wayne Cadero, and dying for proper exegesis. Now, to set this up, I was 24 years old. I just stepped into a church. Now, this church wasn't just any church. This church is a 15,000-person church. We had more staff than people attending here. The senior pastor, Pastor Wayne Cadero. Now, this is the second leadership meeting I've been in. Again, I'm 24. I have many ideas and ambitions, but no track record of success. And he starts teaching on leadership. And because my own being as an immature teacher at that point, I was very obsessed with knowing and with exact rightness. You would lose me if you misquoted. You would lose me if you're exegesis. And if you never heard of exegesis, that's bad. That's how you read the text. if you didn't throw out exegesis, if your Bible work was like, oh, you said Romans, that was Ephesians, I was gone. And this man who had church planted 55 churches, runs a church of 15,000 people, has 120 leaders that he works, is internationally known, was going to be held by my standard as I sat there and judged him because he misquoted Galatians. Can you believe it? And as any good, immature teacher would do, I raised my hand in the middle of 60 people who all looked at him as a guru. And he's like, well, honestly, he said Howley, which is Hawaiian for white boy, because he had not met me yet. And he's like, oh, Howley. I was like, yes, my name's Glenn, and I'd just like to say, where are you getting this? Because in where you just quoted from Galatians and where you just quoted from Acts, that is actually not plausible. So you have created a historical backdrop in order to say we should do this as leaders. Would it not be better for you just to admit you're making things up? Yeah. And me and my brilliance. When he goes, that's okay, I'm going to move on with my lesson. I went, fine. And I don't remember this part quite as clearly. Carl, my good friend, loves the story. Because I remember being, you know, respectful, demure, saying, okay, I'll take notes. Apparently, his telling of the story, I lean back in the chair, kick my feet up on the table, grab my phone, flip open an app, go, okay. That was my first introduction to my senior pastor. Because I was fairly immature. He was wrong. And actually, he was wrong. His reading of the text was terrible. But because of that, I couldn't hear the truth, I couldn't hear the wisdom, I couldn't get the lesson of that day because of my immaturity. Because of a comma going to the wrong spot, suddenly he wasn't worth hearing, even though he was a leader that all other leaders in the States look up to. And I had access that few people did because I was on staff there, and I was only a janitor. So it's not like I was some huge department head. I scrubbed the toilets and told the senior leader, you're wrong, and that's why no one should listen to you. So this story illustrates a couple of things for how we come in for teachers. When we say teachers, usually what we think of is like Pastor Wayne in the front or what I'm doing now. A teacher is someone trained in rhetoric. A teacher is someone who focuses on what is teaching, as the Dictionary of Biblical Imagery says. The events, activities, and images that mark education in our age are missing from education in the biblical world. The classroom with professional teachers who are trained as much in pedagogy as in content area is simply not present in the Bible. Pedagogy is teaching or theory of teaching. The education of ancient Israel was closer to what might be termed deliberate enculturation or no formal education. The biblical images of education and teaching are generally not oriented to schooling activities. So when we say teacher, we think of school. When we say teacher, you might think, do you have a job at Trinity Western? Do you have a job here? Are you a professional teacher? But when you're looking at Ephesians, when you hear the fivefold ministry giftings, teacher's a little closer. It's a little dirtier. It's more, as I titled the sermon, a guru, a sage. Someone who can lead you to paths of wisdom. So the teachers who influence the New Testament are seen in a famous rabbi like Hillel, who used a phrase, tikkun olam, which means to restore, to repair, to perfect the world. And he used this to do something that was heretical for his time. And Hillel was around in the first century BCE. He was a teacher that preceded Jesus. And some would even argue that he is a teacher who preceded Jesus that actually influenced some of the Jewish school that Jesus would speak from. So he first utilized that principle as a rationale for modifying Torah law. So, you know, for them to say, these are the right ways to do things, here's how you step in. He said, no, we must use compassion to juxtapose against the law. We must say, if the law does not help someone live well, then the law must be changed, even if it is sacred. And so he used that to actually protect the poor. And there is a huge section that kind of illustrates what is teacher in Ephesians. What do we mean in our sacred history of a teacher? And the story would be one of the most famous of the Talmud, which shows Hillel converting a Gentile. And it goes, a Gentile comes up to the two big teachers of the day, Shammai and Hillel. And he comes up to Shammai and says, convert me to Judaism on condition that you will teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot. I mean, it's going to be short. Shammai pushed the man away with a building rod he was holding. Undeterred, the man then came before Hillel with the same request. Hillel said to him, that which is hateful unto you, do not do unto your neighbor. This is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Now go and study. So what happened there? The teacher did not do what we would expect, because when we say teacher and you have someone coming to convert, what we might expect is an advanced apologetics. Here's how you know absolute truth, and by absolute truth, I mean here's how you know what I said, and what I said is perfectly right and just. But in ancient ideas of teaching, what Hillel did when he said, convert me, teach me your entire religion while I stand on one foot, he said, show love to your neighbor. If you would hate it, you cannot do it to someone else. And then he took the next step to say, go and study. Because it wasn't enough just to stay there, but he said, if you want to know the essence of what we do, connect in a tangible, real way to other people. And that is the essence of the teacher, the guru, someone that actually walks with you and processes. So we're going to go through a few of the passages in Scripture, because we're going to see what is the wider biblical reading of that would actually correspond to this notion of teaching. So if we look to the first one, the wisdom tradition, which would be seen as like Proverbs, Songs of Solomon, some chapters of Genesis, Psalms. That's just, what are the wise sayings that teach us? We'll start with Proverbs 1. So Proverbs 1, 1 through 7. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. To learn wisdom and moral instruction, to discern wise counsel, to receive moral instruction and skillful living in righteousness, justice, and equity. To impart shrewdness to morally naive and a discerning plan to the young person. Let the wise also hear and gain instruction. Let the discerning acquire guidance to discern the meaning of a proverb and a parable, the sayings of the wise and their riddles. Fearing the Lord is the beginning of moral knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So we see, and we're not going to spend as much time like digging into the text, because this is going to be kind of a larger overview so that we can step into something. But we can see in this that teaching and teachers focused between choosing wisdom and folly, so a good path and a bad path, with the hope of leading people to wise living because they believe wise living embodies who God is. So the topics were born out of lived experience. As you go through Proverbs, you'll see it talked about proper scales in trades. One says that if a fool remains quiet, people will see him as discerning. If he keeps silent, he'll even be seen as wise. Said, or he opens his mouth and removes doubt. So if you talk a lot, you can make yourself look like a fool. It says the same for character, for family, for friends, for spending. Proverbs 31 of the good woman who sells things in the marketplace, wears clothing, gets up early, and just takes care of business. These are wise sayings, saying, how do you step into life? So teachers help us step into life. And you see that in the next couple chapters as it's introducing Proverbs. If you go to Proverbs 3, my child, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments, for they will provide a long and full life. They will add well-being to you. Do not let truth and mercy leave you. Bind them around your neck, write them on the tablet of your heart. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom, the one who obtains understanding. For her benefit is more profitable than silver. Her gain is better than gold. She is more precious than rubies, and none of the things you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hands are riches and honor. Her ways are very pleasant. All her paths are peaceful. She is like a tree of life to those who obtain her. Everyone who grasps hold of her will be blessed. So in the ancient Near East, in the world the Bible was written, your heart wasn't the seat of emotions. It was actually more akin to your mind. So it's telling us not to let your emotions be full of peace and truth, not to say this is how I would step into that these acts make me feel good at the moment. What it's saying is train the way you think and process to be seasoned with mercy and truth. Bind those around your mind, interweave these with the way you think. So when you approach somebody, if you would say, this is not merciful, this is not grace when I approach and I meet somebody, that's what it's telling you to step away from. So the goal in teaching at this point was not historical proficiency or conquering a subject matter, but attaining wisdom by weaving truth and mercy into the way you think. So you see, the goal of teaching at this point, the role of the teacher wasn't so much that when I am done, you would have a proper understanding of the historical placement of Proverbs. The goal of teaching at this point is that as we talk, as we have tension, as we live life closely, as I actually do get to use some of my years of training to say, what is the Bible? We could step into life passionately in a way that brings other people in and shows that we're wise. And by wise, it says it brings about peace, it brings about mercy, it brings about a community defined by these characteristics. Notice what it doesn't say. It brings about doctrinal certainty. It brings definitive borders that you know who we are and who you are. It brings compassion, mercy, truth in a community that's lived out. So I hit the wrong button. Bad Glenn. I'm back. So we're going to go to Ecclesiastes one moment. If you throw up Ecclesiastes 1:1, and we're going to go through this one just as quickly. The words of the teacher and the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So it said in the book of Ecclesiastes, if you read it just as a trigger warning, it's depressing. To the point that you get rabbis in the 14th century that put a preface to the book that says, to put it lightly, this guy was depressed and probably drank too much. Take these words lightly. Because the whole thing is like, why does anything matter? Life sucks. At the end of Ecclesiastes, if you get to 12:9-13, we'll get there. It closes out this book of depression by saying, not only was the teacher wise, but he also taught knowledge to the people. He carefully evaluated and arranged many proverbs. Again, teaching is seen in proverbs and wise sayings. The teacher sought to find delightful words to write accurately truthful sayings. The words of the sages are like prods, something that pushes you. The collected sayings are firmly fixed nails. It holds your things together. They are given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. There is no end to the making of many books. Much study is exhausting to the body. Having heard everything, I have reached this conclusion. Fear God. Keep the commandments. Because this is the whole duty of man. Man would be a gloss for humanity at that point. But notice what he says. One, when he says books are exhausting, in this time period, you probably had 100 books in the world. We have more now. He was just saying anything outside of this wisdom to serve God, do his commandments, and even when you're exhausted, you're saying, I don't know how life works out, that all wisdom, all knowledge, all the proverbs, all the teaching that upholds your life should lead you to this point. Obey God. Keep his commandments, because this is the duty of being human. Again, notice what the teacher is doing. That's not this giant metaphysic framing the entire world. That's not a really hard concept to get. He said, do you want to know what happens after you study everything? You learn how to embrace your humanity. And so we're going to jump to a story that we heard last week, if you were here for the prophet, of Jonah. In Jonah 4:8-11, this is again, Jonah was swallowed by the fish, vomited on the coast, went to Nineveh, was like, repent. Then he had a temper tantrum, and this is where we're coming into the story, just before the temper tantrum. So when the sun began to shine, God sent a hot east wind, so the sun beat down on Jonah's head. He grew faint, So he despaired of life and said, I would rather die than live. God said to Jonah, are you really so very angry about the little plant? And he said, I am as angry as I could possibly be. If any of you have children, this kind of temper tantrum probably sounds pretty natural. Are you mad at your sister? She took my Lego. She should die. And it said with passion, truth, clarity, this is Jonah. It said, I'm as angry as I could possibly be. The Lord said, you were upset about this little plant, something for which you have not worked for. You did not make grow. It grew up overnight and died the next day. Should I not be even more concerned about Nineveh, this enormous city? There are more than 120,000 people in it who do not know right from wrong, as well as many animals. And this is what it's setting up, because Jonah follows a particular teaching style of the ancient world. One, Jonah shows God as teacher, which points to practical movement. God sets Jonah up with a tree that he then destroys, and then uses Jonah's venomous response to say, this is a teaching moment. You don't want humanity, you want revenge. But also the author of the text ends in a question, because this is an ancient way of teaching. Modern ways of teaching at times give you an answer and says, if you learn enough, you'll get to my answer. Ancient ways of teaching, because it's sat with the person, because it's supposed to encourage wisdom and thinking, ends with a question. Because the way the ancient rabbis, the way the scholars talk about it, is what the author of Jonah expected is for you to understand that Nineveh was evil for the time, that they slaughtered Israel, so Jonah was called to a people that killed his people. So his rage was justified, and he sits out, and then you get to sit with that weighted question. Should I not show compassion? Should I not show love to the people I should rightfully hate? Left unanswered. This isn't a frivolous moment of, oh, they believe in water baptism. We believe in sprinkling. They like upbeat music. We like classic hymns. It's not those arguments. This is, you slaughtered my entire people. Assyria was known to have destroyed 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. Whole-scale genocide. And this is where God sets him down and says, you're having a moment. Here's a teaching. Should I not have compassion? And it ends there, because that's the way of teaching. And we can see this in Jesus. Because in Matthew 5, 1 to 2, when he starts what would be called the Sermon on the Mount, a very large block of teaching in Matthew. When he saw the crowds, he went up to the mountain. After he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to teach them by saying, and we're jumping to verse 12. In everything, treat others as you would want them to treat you, for this fulfills the law and the prophets. Who does that sound like? A little bit like Hillel. Convert me. What do I do to keep Torah law? Anything that is hateful for you, you cannot do to somebody else. Jesus just makes it a positive statement as opposed to a negative construction. Jesus makes it an action forward as opposed to a delimiting one. And rather than saying do not do, he says do what is loving. But notice they're both seated in the same place. We're talking about what is faith, what is life, what is teaching, how do we move forward? They sit you down with people close. It focuses mostly on very practical matters of relationship throughout the Sermon on the Mount. It talks about divorce, money, gift, charity, religious observance. It talked about things that are part of your practical life, and he gives re-readings of the text because Jesus says, you have heard it said, but now I say to you. It means here's a literal reading of the text. I'm going to tell you where that misses the point, which is what we practice here. That's the prophetic voice that gives new meaning to an old text. It's the one that says, yes, we used to talk about animal sacrifice. It's not our bag anymore. We have a new thing to talk about because we're moving together as humanity. So we're going to step into the mature and immature teacher. And these will be the points that you can try to relate to. So the transitioning here. The teacher throughout our survey of the text embodied Hillel's Tikkun Olam. It embodied repairing the world by embracing a view that kept rules in dialogue with compassion. So in this way, when we are looking for teachers, we are looking for people who balance rules and compassion, who can be completely present in this moment to highlight the lessons gained along the way. People who teach us how to question in order to help us reflect and become the most God-honoring versions of ourselves rather than simple answers to repeat. So teachers can explain the whole system while you stand on one leg, to inspire you to discover a more beautiful, ever-expanding community. For this is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Go and study. So now we're going to take a closer look at the shadow and the light, the vice and the virtue, or as I'm going to call it, the immature and the mature teacher. So point 1A in the back of your little handout. The immature teacher creates distance. As you saw in Jonah, so if you put up Jonah 4, starting with 1, it said, just before that temper tantrum that we just read, this is what preceded it, said this displeased Jonah when Nineveh was saved. And he became very angry. He prayed to the Lord and said, "Oh Lord, this is just what I thought would happen when I was in my own country. This is what I tried to prevent by attempting to escape to Tarshish, because I knew that you are gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in mercy, one who relents concerning threatened judgment. So now, Lord, kill me, because I would rather die than live." And the Lord said, "Are you so very angry?" Jonah left the city, sat down east of it. He made a shelter for himself there and sat down under it in the shade to see what would happen to the city. So in this, for Jonah as kind of our archetype of the teacher, the knowledge of God had Jonah walk away, not only from God, but from the city. Because knowledge in this point for the immature teacher allows you to separate, like you heard of me with Pastor Wayne, someone years my senior, someone levels above me in wisdom and insight, someone that for all intended purposes, I should have been grateful that I had time even to learn from. But from immaturity, I was able to say, you got one thing wrong, I can shut you out. In the immaturity aspect of us, sometimes we do that within the church. We say, I disagree with one point of view, I don't have to listen anymore. You got this wrong over here, I'm done with you. And we very much embody the 24-year-old self that I was. So have you let rightness, what you know, separate you? It looked a little like putting your feet on the desk and picking up your phone. So like Jonah ending with a question, immaturity presents us an opportunity for growth. So point 1B, opportunity for growth, allow knowledge to draw you into community rather than isolation. Move towards people. In this, I would say, as I started to grow, a couple of years past that point with Pastor Wayne, I had an opportunity that scared one of my professors. Because I was known to be a rambunctious student. At times, I was known to be a little controversial. I was me. His son was praying, said, "I need a mentor, I need someone to step in with." And so Josh Higashi hears from God that he told his father, who was the dean of students, so knew of my antics, Guy Higashi, "God told me Glenn was supposed to be my mentor." And as any self-respecting father would, he said, "Pray again." I think you misheard. And he said he came back a week later and said, "No, this is what I really believe God's telling me, that Glenn should be my mentor right now." So Guy Higashi approached me and said, "Josh would like you to take him on as a mentoree. I have reservations about you. We're going to check in with each other." I was like, "You got it." But I became the mentor, and I got to witness my growth as my experience drew Josh into community. Because what Josh was questioning was, he was a part of the youth group, he was kind of ahead of the curve, he was a bit smarter than most. And he said, "I've come to the point that the teaching no longer teaches me, that the challenges are no longer challenging, I can usually fill out the outline before the pastor's done, this is boring. And I got to sit with him as a sage and mentor to ask him a question. Because Josh said, I have nothing more to learn from TNG, which was the ministry he was a part of. And so I asked him, if you've gained so much, what can you give? If it's become droll, if it's become boring, if you've said, it's so routine, it doesn't matter, he said, how do you step in? That question bugged him till he became a leader of the youth ministry, went to Bible college, and later contacted me saying, the question of what do I have to give has changed the way he moved into life. So for point two, the mature teacher, if the immature teacher creates distance and boundaries, the mature teacher is dedicated to the process of people development. That's actually what we're dedicated to here. As Coast Hills, what we want to see is for you to find your most God-honoring self, and in that, why we're talking about the APES, the fivefold ministry, because this is what we truly believe, that this will build, this will expand, we'll become who we're meant to be as we become it together. We are in the business of process, not final destination. Our goal is to walk alongside each other to gain wisdom, not perfect answers. So like with Josh Higashi, the development affected both of us. So I want to consider, just for brevity and time, I'm going to skip one of the passages. So I'm just going to do the two points with Jesus. So Luke 9, 49 to 56. John answered, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. We tried to stop him because he is not a disciple along with us. But Jesus said to him, do not stop him, for whoever is not against you is for you. Now when the days drew near for him to be taken up, Jesus set out resolutely to go to Jerusalem. He sent messengers on ahead of him. As they went along, they entered a Samaritan village to make things ready in advance for him. But the villagers refused to welcome him because he was determined to go to Jerusalem. Now when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to call fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But Jesus turned and rebuked. They went to another village. Now, in this moment for the mature that being affected by the environment, notice what Jesus' presence is. He's with his disciples, so he's responding to their immediate questioning. In this, there's actually a different manuscript because there's a couple different variations of the story for the ancient histories of our Bibles. And so I'm going to share one byline that they have because it actually gives out what was the rebuke that Jesus gave. So a minor variant gives Jesus' presence more weight by sharing his rebuke. And when they said, should I call fire down? Jesus rebuked them and said, you do not know of what spirit you are. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy a being or a soul, rather to save them. So dedication is being present, pulling from the embodied experience like this moment. Where the first one, the immature disciples say, let's draw lines, they're not a part of us. And he says, you can't. Are they doing good work? Judge the work of the people. Then they're for us. The second one, they say, they refused us, they dishonored us, said, okay, I'm gonna call fire down. And Jesus says, you don't even understand who you are. When you're hate-filled, angry, going after the dirty other, said, that's not the spirit we are. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy, but to save. The Son of Man did not come to call fire, but to bring people to a table. And that is the nature of teaching. And we'll go one more just to show that Jesus was even affected by the people he met. Because sometimes when we get Jesus into our mind, he's not a historical person. He's this kind of transcendent thing up here that is never affected by the lowly things down here. But when we go to Matthew 15, and you get to meet the Syrophoenician woman. After going out from there, Jesus went to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from the area came and cried out, have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is horribly demon-possessed. But he did not answer her a word. Then his disciples came up and begged him, send her away, because she keeps on crying out after us. So he answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and bowed down before him and said, Lord, help me. It is not right, he said, to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Yes, Lord, she replied, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, woman, your faith is great. Let what you want be done for you. And her daughter was healed. I'll point out one thing. Jesus didn't respond to the crying woman following him in the crowd saying, Master, Master, please, I'm desperate. He responded to his disciples' turn and say, she's annoying. Then he turned and saw her. When he saw her, he did not see part of the goal because he said, you're a Syrophoenician woman. I came for Israel to complete the story of Israel. And she said, yes, but I'm part of humanity. He's like, not good enough. And she said, I deserve the crumbs. And it actually has punctuation there with the exclamation point of thing. That is a declaration of Jesus said, wow, your faith. I'll do this. And there's a few times punctuated like that throughout Luke to where it shows Jesus being affected and responding, not this static entity over here, but dynamically involved in the process of life and taking those moments to teach. I think some scholars would even say taking those moments to learn. But that one is up to you, which scholars you want to follow. I know which ones I do. So have fun with it. But Jesus was affected by the Canaanite woman's pursuit. Dedication to process is being open to being affected. Open to seeing because of your students' questions. And this will go into my last story. Dr. Larry Perkins is an expert in Septuagint studies at Trinity Western. Not Trinity Western, my apologies, Acts. He does Bible stuff. So in that, this guy is who the world goes to on questions of Greek Exodus. I got to do a directed study with him. And what I said was being open to the process, because teachers are dedicated to the process, means you can be affected by your students' questions. You don't act like you have all the answers. This guy is papered. He has a PhD, publicated across the world, commonly sought after. And he sat down with me to go over Exodus 34. He was showing me how to use software that used to take people 8 months of going through papyri, now took us 35 seconds to do a search. He marveled at it, say, see how amazing this is? Now you do it so you can see how this works for your text studies. And when we got into the ever-pressing question, I know this one's going to be shocking, we were arguing over the objective or subjective genitive. I know, right? And in that passage, if it was an object genitive, then it was the object of the wrath of the main subject. And so God was overlooking something. If it was subjective, that means God was subject overlooking. But why that was important is because he already translated the book and had it published. And I said, that doesn't make sense for the way you translated to me, who's just learned his ABCs in Greek, because the text you took away in the Hebrew to get to this made it seem like God's supposed to be more innocent in the Greek story. And he actually stopped and said, actually, that's a good question. I have about 15 other passages I have to look at, but I'm going to look at that. Thank you. And he credited me. I was like, yeah, because I said, are you sure? And he goes, let me go through 1,500 years of papyri real quick. Yeah, you could be right. And that was my discovery. You can see how ridiculous that is, right? He was dedicated to the process because he saw in me someone who could question, and he helped me realize it. So this is my closing point. Why do we go over all this? Why are we going over so much biblical text on what is a teacher, what is ancient teaching? Why are we going over the fivefold ministries? If you resonate, not say with any one of the sermons you've heard, whether it's pastor, prophet, teacher now, we're going to be going into apostle, an evangelist. If you resonate with you, if you see yourself in it, if some of my audacity before a leader said, I've done that, I was that twit, you might actually share some temperament with me. And I'd say if you resonate with the teacher's passion, move towards and participate in their development. Become a mentor. Ask AJ about the possibilities of youth. Because the teacher is someone who sits with, helps train, gets people towards wisdom. Develop a lesson plan for your life group. So you have something to share. And remember, teaching in the ancient way in Ephesians is about community. You're teaching from within community, not above or apart from. Find a mentor if you have a subject you're trying to learn. Be proactive in your faith, in your engagement, in the fact that if you are a teacher, you need to learn something. Like I was privileged with Dr. Perkins. There's someone in your life that can help you progress. And this is for us to get skin in the game. If you wanted to be outside the church, I am pretty sure if you came to A.J. McKellen School and said, you know, it'd be great. You have a tutoring program. I would like to be a part of it because I identify myself as a teacher, as part of the ministry of the church. I could be a tutor for the sixth graders. There is a spot for you and your talent. There's a place for you to grow, to serve, and to build. And in short, we need teachers to help people grow. This means we need to become invested in our community and in our development. And that goes for whichever part of the fivefold ministry you resonate with. Because together, we can realize the hope of the kingdom here that we never could apart.